and God bless the United States.
Cat got your teeth, Mr. President?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That was the best laugh I had all week.
I got a feeling there's something right.
Oh, I needed
that. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Take what I can get these
days. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm
from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. In Oregon on 91.7 KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1. In Palinville, New York on 102.9 WLPP. In Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR. In New Orleans on WHIV 102.3. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950. KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Detour Talk, Radio Sputnik, and many other fine affiliates, both terrestrial and on the internets, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com, here with my trusty sidekick
and producer,
producer Desi Doyen, in this yet another smoky day out here in L.A. But at least, hey, Des, your teeth are staying in, unlike the President of the United States.
Allegedly.
I mean, the President of the United States.
Oh, that's me.
Coming up on today's program, several stories that we have not been able to get to over the past week, thanks to, as usual these days, a ridiculous amount of breaking news that seems to derail other stuff, often equally or more important, frankly. So, want to get to some of those stories today, and if time allows, I've received quite a bit of listener mail over the past week to bradcast@bradblog.com on a number of the stories we've covered. We will see if the radio gods allow me to get to at least a few of them a little bit later in today's show. But first, as I mentioned, and if I choke throughout today's show, it might be because of that smoke.
Or the record low humidity.
Yeah, both of them are having grave circumstances around Southern California still again today. An update on the continuing wildfires out here in Southern California that have seemingly been moving southward after breaking out several days ago up in Ventura County. Moving down here in and around Los Angeles over the past day or so, and now it appears farther south down in San Diego, about 2 hours south of where we are here in Los Angeles. And again, thanks to those who have asked, we are doing fine. We're here in Hollywood. We're smelling quite a bit of smoke again today. But the skies in the north seem blue and the skies in the south seem quite smoky. Down south, as it is here in Los Angeles, retirement communities built on golf courses, thoroughbreds in racehorse stables, and other usually serene sites were engulfed by flames as the San Diego area now became the latest front in this California wildfire fight. The fire broke out there yesterday amid dry, hot, windy conditions that continue across the region that would be extreme for any season, but are especially stunning just 2 weeks from winter. That fire in San Diego, as we went to air here, exceeded at least 6 square miles in a matter of hours, burned dozens of houses, tore through a community known for its avocado orchards, horse ranches, Three people were burned while escaping the flames. I believe we've had one death now, Desi Doyen, in this fire?
Up in Ventura.
Up in the Ventura fire.
Yes.
But yeah, surprisingly, happily, so far anyway, many fewer deaths than the fires we saw up in Northern California just a few weeks ago.
The emergency alert system that they've upgraded now seems to be working and getting people alerted sooner so they can get out faster.
The fire near San Diego was on the eastern border of the Marine Corps' vast Camp Pendleton. Marine and Navy aircraft are now joining the battle down there, according to the fire chief at the base. Meanwhile, firefighters up in Ventura, which is about 130 miles to the north. So these fires are, it's a huge swath of area that we're talking about where these fires are breaking out. The firefighters in Ventura tried to corral the largest and most destructive fire in the state of late that has so far destroyed some 500 buildings. That's the so-called Thomas Fire. It's grown to nearly 200 square miles since breaking out almost a week ago on Monday. Fire crews made enough progress against large fires here around us, around L.A., to lift most of the evacuation orders in the area. Although, as I said, while it was we had smelled smoke sort of 2 days ago, yesterday wasn't bad, now we're smelling it again, so I don't know. I don't know if there's new fires that are popping up in the area.
Well, right now there are six major fires that are active across Southern California. That's big enough.
Yeah, no kidding. In the fire burning north of San Diego, as the flames had approached the elite San Luis Rey Downs training facility for thoroughbreds, AP reports, many of them, more than 450 horses, were just cut loose to prevent them from being trapped in their stables if barns caught fire.
When barns caught fire, and actually 8 barns caught fire, and the trainers were letting the horses out amid the smoke. They said it was pandemonium and chaos.
Yeah, herds of horses apparently were seen galloping past flaming palm trees in a chaotic escape in a normally idyllic place. Not all of those horses apparently survived. The California Horse Racing Board said approximately 25 horses were killed when 8 barns burned, and others in adjacent pastures were unaccounted for at this hour. Surviving horses were taken to the Del Mar racetrack, and all of the races at Los Alamitos, at the race course down south there on Friday, all of those races were canceled as the racing community mourned. These were
elite thoroughbreds, $100,000 horses.
Now, the AP story cites dry, hot, windy conditions that would be extreme for any season, but are especially stunning just 2 weeks from winter. But though AP has been pretty good on climate in general, they don't mention any reason why, in this particular story, any reason why it is so hot and dry and windy. Desi Doyen, scientists, had we paid attention to them, saw this coming at least a decade ago.
Oh, yes, easily. So there's a couple of things to keep in mind here. Remember, climate change does not cause extreme weather events. It does not cause the wildfire. It makes them more extreme. So historically, we have Santa Ana winds. They occur in the fall. They're a seasonal weather pattern. It's been happening like forever. California's landscape has also evolved to burn and be dry. However, these mega wildfires in wintertime, that is new. Because of global warming, our baseline has changed. California is now warmer and drier overall, and we're also seeing really extreme swings in weather events from hot and dry to cold and wet. So remember, we had that historic 5-year drought. That was the worst in 1,000 years. And then last year's El Nino brought record rains. Remember the Oroville Dam that almost overflowed and broke? And then
those rains caused a huge growth in vegetation all over the place.
Exactly. So then when this summer we had record heat waves, then in October we had record heat waves, and in November we had record heat waves.
And dryness. We're seeing just a fraction of the rain that we would in normal times have during this.
So we've had record heat waves, no rain, All that vegetation is dead, so that's a lot of new fuel. And yes, this was predicted 10 years ago that climate change was going to alter California's fire season and make it longer. The scientists at the time did computer models that looked ahead, and they predicted that our weather patterns were going to shift, that the Santa Ana winds, instead of coming during September and October and then being followed by rain.
Which, by the way, is when I remember them. I've been out in California for about 20 years now, and it was September, October, you'd get these huge warm winds coming in from the desert, not quite as much in, well, November and now December.
Right, and that's what those computer models 10 years ago predicted, going from the Santa Anas in September, October, then to November and December, which would be fine if we would get some rain, but we haven't gotten any rain. And there's a reason for that, too. There's a second study. So that was 10 years ago. Second study out this week talks about how it's the loss of Arctic sea ice. Now, this is a new and emerging theory. This is being actively studied
right now.
The loss
of Arctic sea ice?
Yes. What happens
in the Arctic is affecting us here in California?
What happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. So this is something you and I have talked about before. Again, I have to stress that this is an emerging area of research, so it is not well established, but it's looking increasing like this is the case.
You're so safe. You're so conservative. Had you just sounded the alarm 10 years ago with that study? Oh, wait, you actually did. So go ahead.
Yeah. So anyway, so the changing weather patterns, this is how it works. When you have melting Arctic sea ice, that means there's less ice reflecting the sun's heat back out into space. It also means that the open water there absorbs more heat that warms the air in the atmosphere above the Arctic Ocean. So when the Arctic Ocean warms and the atmosphere above it warms, that actually changes the weather patterns of the jet stream. The jet stream is what moves our weather across the continent. And when you slow the jet stream down, you make it wavier, you get stalled weather patterns like heat waves and rainstorms, and that blocks rainfall from getting to California.
You're so sciencey. So much science. Who cares about science? Science doesn't matter. They don't know what they're talking about. They're all just doing it to make money. So the scientists and Al Gore can make money. That's what we've been told for the past 10 years, instead of what you've been telling us, what you've been warning us about on the Green News Report and on this show. Had we just listened to those scientists and taken action, maybe we could have avoided at least some of this. AP reports this week, as I noted, they have been good on climate. Seth Borenstein in particular has been very good. In a new study, a new analysis from the Associated Press out this week, when it comes to filling jobs dealing with complex science, environment, and health issues, the Trump administration is nominating people with fewer science academic credentials than their Obama predecessors, by far. Of 43 Trump administration nominees in science-related positions, almost 60%. In those science-related positions, did not have a master's degree or a doctorate in a science or health field, according to the AP analysis. The AP analyzed 65 Senate-confirmable positions that deal with science and environment, many of which have not yet been filled after more than 10 months of this administration. And they got a quote from Christy Todd Whitman. Remember, she's a Republican. She's a former Republican New Jersey governor, and she was the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Remember when we used
during
to complain
years,
during
yes.
the George W. Bush years? Remember when we used to complain that she, of all people, was in charge of the EPA?
Yeah.
Boy, would I love to have her back in charge at this point, given what we have now. She said, this is just reflective of the disdain that the Trump administration has shown for science. This is Christy Todd Whitman, a Republican. She says, when you're talking about science, issues about protecting human health, it's very, very complicated and sophisticated work. You need background and experience to handle these things, she said. This lack of scientists is especially noticeable in the Energy Department, which oversees, well, according to Sarah Palin, remember her? According to Sarah Palin, they oversee, what was it, oil and gas and so forth at the Energy Department. In fact, the Energy Department oversees the nation's nuclear stockpile. So zero of the seven Trump energy science-oriented nominees, including the Undersecretary for Science at the Energy Department, none of them has even a master's degree in a science field. Five of their Obama predecessors had master's degree in science fields. Four had science doctorates.
And some of them were Nobel Prize winners.
Yeah, exactly. Two Obama energy secretaries both had doctorates in physics. Stephen Chu was a Nobel Prize winner in physics. Trump's energy secretary, Rick Perry, on the other hand, has a bachelor's degree in animal science and was a former governor. This is just hollowing out of expertise in these posts, says Max Boykoff. He's director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado. He says it's a really worrisome trend. Many of the Trump nominees who do have advanced science degrees, especially those at the EPA, come from working in or with the industries that they are now supposed to be regulating. So where we do have scientists, they're coming from the oil and gas industries that they're supposed to regulate.
They're shills from the industry that have shielded the industry from accountability and plan to do even more of that in these positions of authority.
Even some Republicans are raising questions now about the independence of the scientific advice coming from these people. EPA Chief Scott Pruitt has also raised eyebrows by purging academic scientists from the agency's science advisory board, claiming that because they received EPA grants, somehow their
input is questionable, is a conflict of interest.
He's replaced them with industry-connected so-called experts. So no conflict of interest there on bringing in people from the industry that they're supposed to regulate.
That's called regulatory capture.
William K. Riley, who was EPA administrator under George H.W. Bush, said that the pattern of a repeated tilt toward industry scientists and ones known for disparaging the record of the agencies they are appointed to is worrisome. In 35% of the 65 Senate confirmable positions that deal with science and environment, the Trump administration hasn't nominated anyone yet at all, including four top positions at the White House Office of, wait for it, Science and Technology Policy. So he's got no scientists in the White House. He has fake scientists, or at least industry scientists, in a few positions elsewhere in these other agencies. And beyond that, 35% of the Senate confirmable positions that have to do with science, nobody's nominated at all. The AP report goes on here to note that initial appointments by Obama included two winners of the Nobel Prize for Physics. That would be Energy Secretary Chu and Carl Wieman, who was Associate Director for Science of the White House Office of Science and Technology, where no one has been nominated, and a winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant, also White House Science Advisor John Holdren under Obama. He had tried to appoint another Nobel winner as well, Peter Diamond, who had won the Nobel Prize for Economics, to the Federal Reserve Board. But that was held up by Republicans in the Senate under Obama, who said that that guy didn't have enough experience, and that Nobel Prize winner, his nomination was withdrawn.
Well, you know, facts have a liberal bias.
And, you know, the Senate obviously has a bias. They're nominating these people who are wildly have no experience at all in these jobs. And yet this Nobel Prize winner, he didn't have enough experience. All right. Quick break here. Coming up in advance of Tuesday's U.S. Senate election in Alabama, between an accused Republican pedophile who was tossed off the state Supreme Court twice for failure to comply with the federal courts, And a Democratic former U.S. attorney who successfully prosecuted members of the KKK, members of the Klan, for killing young African-American girls in the 60s. That's the contest on Tuesday. Amidst that, we've got some news about fraud, both voter fraud and election fraud, and the fight for public oversight of that very important U.S. Senate special election. That's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Well, our version of it, anyway. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yep, big U.S. Senate special election on Tuesday in Alabama. We will, as you might expect, be keeping our eyes on that. We have a story about that. People who are trying to keep their eyes on that election on Tuesday, and specifically the results, that in a moment. But first, Steve Curtis was the Colorado State Republican Party chairman from 1997 to 1999, and he caused a bit of a stir just ahead of the 2016 presidential election when he said on KLZ 560 AM up in Colorado on the right-wing radio show that he hosted there at the time, he said, quote, "It seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but virtually every case of voter fraud I can remember in my lifetime was committed by Democrats."
God.
Well, let me go ahead then, Mr. Curtis, and correct you. You are wrong, even though voter fraud is fairly rare and extremely rare at the polling place itself, which is where Republicans are trying to change the laws to make it harder to vote, claiming there is massive voter fraud going on at the polling place. So it's extremely rare there versus via absentee vote-by-mail voting. There, voter fraud specifically is we find it much more often, yeah. I could cite case after case, incident after incident of voter fraud, yes, carried out by Republicans, that Mr. Curtis, the former Republican Party chair in Colorado, seems to not know anything about. Including cases of those who attempted to vote multiple times, yes, at the polling place, and yes, for Donald Trump in the 2016 election. And I can cite dozens and dozens of other cases of voter fraud by Republicans. High-profile Republicans, in fact. Even if they don't report them on Fox News or over at Breitbart, which I'm sure is the only news that Curtis ever actually learns about, we have covered incidents of fraud by high-profile Republicans, from Mitt Romney to Ann Coulter to Newt Gingrich. I could, yes, go on and on and on. You can just look them up over at bradblog.com if you prefer, which I suspect Steve Curtis doesn't read. So that's one of the reasons why he doesn't know anything about all of this high-profile Republican, yes, voter fraud.
He may not be familiar with Google.
Now, not that there is a massive epidemic of such voter fraud, but since that's what Republicans, including the President of the United States, have been charging, that there's this mass epidemic of Democrats committing voter fraud,
which is a lie, and
which
not true.
Is a lie. The president has been lying about this for years, and it's important to respond to that from time to time, especially when the president himself has claimed, without any actual evidence, that anywhere from 3 to 5 million people voted illegally in the 2016 election, which he lost, at least by the popular vote, by some 3 million votes, reportedly. And that's why, of course, he says that anywhere from 3 to 5 million of the votes were actually people voting illegally. So far, no evidence of anything anywhere near that at all. But since Curtis, the former Colorado State Republican Party chair, Since there apparently are no cases in his lifetime of voter fraud that have been committed by anybody but Democrats, well, let me give him a reminder, a new reminder, another one, another case of, yes, Republican voter fraud that we have for you today. Actually, another actually proven and documented case, not just made up hearsay like Donald Trump has been claiming. But this is a case that actually Curtis may now be quite familiar with from the Greeley, Colorado Tribune this week. By his own admission on the witness stand this past Wednesday afternoon, October 2016 was a rough month for former Colorado Republican Party chairman Steve Curtis. It was the month during which he is accused of committing, yes, voter fraud and forgery after he filled out his ex-wife's ballot and mailed it in. She had recently, 11 months earlier, moved out of their Firestone, Colorado home, and at the time she lived in Charleston, South Carolina. Yet Curtis said in court on Wednesday, although he concluded he must have filled out the ballot and submitted it in an envelope with his ex-wife's name on it, that he had no memory of the incident for months. That's because he said he was in the grips of a severe diabetic episode at the time. Apparently, he's lived with type 1 diabetes for almost 30 years, he said, and it is a very debilitating condition. Although over the past 30 years, it has been difficult for Curtis. Still, he was able to rise to prominence as the Colorado GOP chair from 1997 to 1999. And during that time, he did not apparently shy away from hard work in other parts of his career either. By October of 2016, when things were so rough that he could not remember committing voter fraud, before going on to say that he was unaware of any fraud other than by Democrats, at that time he was working between 80 and 95 hours a week at three different jobs, including his career as a right-wing talk show host on the radio for the Aurora-based radio station KLZ AM 560, a job that he also had to commute to multiple times a week. So he was able to do all of that, but he can't remember filling out this ballot
that
illegally,
wasn't his,
unlawfully, and signing it
with somebody else's signature
and sending it in. Right. During October and the months that followed, he said that his blood sugar was consistently high that month, and that's why he said he doesn't remember filling out his own ballot on October 16, filling out his ex-wife's ballot on October 22, or putting both of those ballots into the mail on October 24. When confronted with evidence in the months leading up to the trial, however, he conceded that all three of those events, yes, took place. If convicted, the Greeley, Colorado Tribune reports, the former state Republican chair faces up to 3 years in prison. Well, good news. That was Wednesday when he testified on the stand. And on Thursday, Steve Curtis, the former chairman of the Colorado Republican Party, was found guilty by a Weld County jury of voter fraud and forgery. His ex-wife had moved, by the way, to South Carolina and learned that her ballot had already been cast when she had called the county clerk in Weld County to see how she could vote from South Carolina. The deputy district attorney, Tate Costin, argued during closing arguments of the case that he knew exactly what he was doing. He received the ballot in the mail, opened it, voted, signed it, sealed it back up, sent it in. And says that Costin said if he were going to sign a name during this confused diabetic state, wouldn't he sign his own name? Why her name? She hadn't lived in the house for 11 months, he said. Curtis is the third Coloradan to be convicted of voter fraud this year, though apparently the only one to be convicted for voting fraudulently in the 2016 election that Donald Trump says 3 to 5 million voters illegally voted in, and yet they can't find any other ones in Colorado, even though they've got a Republican Secretary of State there.
I wonder if Steve Curtis will remember this one.
Oh, he'll have a few months to think about it, I think, in jail. Actually, perhaps a few years in jail to think about it. At least I hope. A Colorado Springs woman. And the reason I hope, by the way, is, you know, yes, it's a fairly minor crime. But when you have this jerk going on the radio, going on AM radio, going on commercial radio and telling
millions of
Italians,
people.
Tens of thousands, perhaps millions of people. Yeah. That he can't remember any sort of fraud, that all the fraud that happens is by Democrats. Well, you know what? I hope he gets a whole bunch of years in jail to think about that knowing misinformation that he's been putting out there, that he and the rest of his party have been putting out there for years, convincing people that it's a good idea to institute new laws that will make it harder for people to vote, harder for millions of people to vote, harder for, yes, Republicans to vote, but often, more often, Democratic-leaning voters, students, minorities, elderly people. But frankly, I don't care who he's making it harder to vote for. I'm going to call him out for it. I'm going to call out anybody who makes it more difficult for legitimate voters to be able to cast their vote. He was the third Coloradan this year to be convicted of voter fraud. A Colorado Springs woman also pleaded guilty in early September to voter fraud and forgery for casting a vote in her deceased mother's name back in 2013. Another man of Golden, Colorado, pleaded guilty in February to voting. Not a man, that's a woman. Tony Lee Newbill pleaded guilty to voting on her dead father's ballot.
Again, these are vote by mail, not in person.
Yep.
Voter fraud, which is, you know, what you've always said. That's what they require the IDs for, because Republicans are trying to make people believe something that is completely not true.
Yeah. And by the way, when Democrats say, oh, voter fraud doesn't happen, I always correct them. They're making a mistake to say that. Because, yes, voter fraud does happen, but it's almost always via mail, via absentee ballot like this. And these sorts of, frankly, sad cases. You know, someone's wife dies and the husband votes in on her ballot, you know, that gets sent. Not a massive. This is how voter fraud tends to happen in this country. And often, yes, by Republicans and Democrats. But it's this usually, nickel and dime kind of vote by mail fraud. And that's just one of the reasons, by the way, that I am no fan of vote by mail unless it's absolutely necessary for someone who can't vote in person, hopefully on election day for some reason.
Or you can drop off your vote by mail in person at the precinct on election
day. Yeah, but still, if you're going to have it at home, that means that voter fraud can happen. You can sell your vote. You can show it to somebody. You can, intimidate your wife into voting the way you want her to vote.
That's
so that's
true.
Why I say vote
all
at
true.
The polls.
Yes.
Is better. Despite, I know, a lot of folks who listen to the show up in Oregon, Washington State, they have all vote by mail there. Colorado now does as well. So you'll see more and more of that sort of thing. In any event, the Colorado Democratic Party took the opportunity to take a dig at Curtis and Republicans. After the verdict was announced, saying this is Eric Walker, who said, a spokesman for the Colorado Democratic Party, voter fraud is virtually non-existent, is a virtually non-existent problem that Republicans use as an excuse to justify voter suppression tactics. In fact, says Walker, voter fraud is so rare that the only person to be charged and convicted of committing voter fraud in Colorado in the 2016 election is the former chair of the Colorado Republican Party. So Curtis is scheduled to be sentenced in January. The forgery charge carries a possible sentence of up to 3 years in prison. So that's voter fraud. Very rare, very difficult to flip an entire election with it. Election fraud, on the other hand, by those who have direct access to computers that are rarely, if ever, checked for errors or manipulation, that's another question. The computers that tally our vote, that count our votes, and if you've got 30 seconds of access to some of these machines, which, of course, election officials often do, The people, the vendors, the private vendors who make these machines, they often have that kind of access to these systems. If you have that kind of access, you can flip an entire election like that in a moment. You know, the idea that getting hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in the case of Donald Trump, people to vote illegally at the polls with nobody catching them or even by absentee ballots in order to flip an election. Well, that's a much more difficult to see. But
well, it's the dumbest way to steal an election. Well, I mean, if you could just go to the computer and spread a virus, yep, or et cetera.
Get an insider or hack into these systems. Well, we talked with John Brakey, longtime election integrity advocate, on this show a few days ago. You can download that report, that broadcast, at bradblog.com. He is trying. He's fighting like hell for oversight of the Alabama U.S. Senate election on Tuesday, where they use computers. They have paper ballots across almost all the voters in Alabama will use paper ballots, hand-marked paper ballots. But those paper ballots are counted by computers. And the particular computers that they use in Alabama, they're some of the newer versions, they're digital digital scanners that actually take a photograph of the ballot itself as it goes through. And they count hundreds of ballots per minute, very fast, runs them right through there. They take a photograph of it, and then that photograph is read by the computer to determine the results. Now, though, that computer may be programmed correctly, may take a photograph correctly or incorrectly. The computer may read what that photograph says, right or wrong. We have no way of knowing unless we actually count those paper ballots by hands, unless human beings actually count those paper ballots by hand. However, there is a way, but it's very hard to get at those paper ballots. And in Alabama, in fact, state law says that those paper ballots will be run through if there is a recount, and the race between Roy Moore, the Republican candidate who has been charged with accused of all sorts of sexual improprieties, versus the Democratic candidate Doug Jones, the former U.S. attorney. That race is likely to be very, very close. We will see. We will find out. But if it is, getting at those paper ballots is very, very difficult, if not impossible. And so,
and a recount would be on those same
machines.
Would
be on those machines. They'll run those paper ballots back through those same machines. Right. So fighting to get at those paper ballots, we might be able to do it through a public records request, but that takes months. And, of course, Roy Moore, if he wins, or Doug Jones, if he wins, will already be seated in the U.S. Senate, will already be voting for and against this huge shift of money from the middle class to the rich through this so-called tax plan from the Republicans. But in the meantime, there is something. Those photographs of those paper ballots, those are digital, and they are stored by the voting machines. If the voting machines, the voting tabulators, these digital scanners, if those digital scanners are set in such a way to save those photographs could be released immediately. Doesn't hurt anyone. Doesn't harm the paper ballots in any way. They could just be released to the public so we can try to count those ballots ourselves. Well, that was what John Brakey from Arizona, longtime election integrity guy, was on this show talking about and saying that he was going to trying to work with the folks in Alabama, with the election officials there, to encourage them to turn on these ballot images on these machines, to turn on the setting that would save them instead of delete them immediately. Well, he's down in Alabama now, and in fact, he has filed suit. This is a press release from the group that he's working with. It says a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, and a minister yesterday.
Walk into a bar.
Yeah, I know. Sounds like a joke. Yesterday, they asked a Montgomery Circuit Court judge to order protection of election materials from the Senate special election. The voters say these materials are essential for verifying the accuracy of the election results and that the state plans to destroy them. At issue are these ballot images created by digital scanners where the paper ballots are fed into. 85% of vote counting machines across the state of Alabama use these type of systems to read the ballot images. Brakey says in this press release, John Brakey says that the Secretary of State's office is legally required to set procedures to assure that all election materials for 22 months after a federal election are retained. Even the envelopes, he says, from absentee ballots have to be kept. Destroying the ballot images, he argues, is illegal. We're only asking the Secretary of State to follow the law. One of the plaintiffs, Victoria Tuggle of Cullman County, Alabama, said we need to make sure we can check on the results of the election. If there's a question, the confusing ballot design for the special election makes it extra important that human eyes can verify that the machines are counting votes correctly. And yes, it is a there's only one race on the ballot. Roy Moore versus Doug Jones. That's it. This should be an incredibly simple ballot. But because of, I guess, the way the laws work in Alabama, they have an option there for straight party ticket voting. So you can vote for the Republican Party or you can vote for the Democratic Party. So essentially, where there should be two choices, Republican Roy Moore, Democrat Doug Jones, there's actually four choices.
On this ballot,
and it's unclear to me if these machines will be set properly or if, you know, if you check straight party ticket Democrat and you check Doug Jones, will that be thrown out?
As an overvote,
yeah. Or if you choose straight party Democrat and not Doug Jones, will that be ignored as an undervote in the race? So having these ballots, these ballot images here could be very helpful. And the public could look at those images and make sure that the machines count every ballot where the voter intent is clear, says the plaintiff Tuggle. So another plaintiff in the case from Madison County added, we're fortunate that most of the voting machines in Alabama create these ballot images, but not every state has them, and they can really make our elections more transparent. And Brakey notes, as he did on this on the broadcast a few days ago, that in a similar action in Arizona earlier this year, the judge did rule that ballot images are public record and must be preserved as outlined by law. So these machines, again, they can be set. They point out that you can save all the ballot images. You can save only the ballot images on write-in votes, or you can save no images at all. And Brakey has been told that most of these machines have been set to save ballot images only in the event of write-in votes. He's trying to get them just to turn them on, to save all of the ballots, to just flip that switch on those machines. The voters filing the case are asking the judge to order all of Alabama counties to do so. And they argue this can easily be done in time for Tuesday's special election. And John Brakey sends me an update late today saying that there is a court hearing on this matter. They filed the suit. There's a court hearing Monday morning in front of Judge Roman Schall.
24 hours before the election.
Right. And at that point, somehow they're going to, I guess, change all of the tabulators, which is also fraught with potential problems doing that late in the game, changing the switch. Why that switch isn't on in the first place, I don't know. All right, one more, though. This is related. New York Daily News has noticed what John Brakey and friends are doing in Alabama.
Oh, yay!
In an editorial today from the New York Daily News editorial board, they write, in that Alabama special election for Senate Tuesday, officials are flouting federal and state laws mandating that all election records be retained. This is dangerous, the Daily News writes. Alabama counts votes like New York does. Paper ballots get fed through computerized scanners, which photograph them and generate a tally. But Alabama, breaking the law, doesn't keep the images. That could cause havoc in a recount. They note that in New York, images are retained and are publicly available. However, in Saratoga County, New York, where its city charter amendment was defeated by 10 votes last month, the Board of Elections has denied requests for those images. See how hard they make this?
They say that this is going to make it so you can recount, and then they stop
you. Well, then they don't let you see that. You can't see the paper ballots, and you can't see the images, even where they exist. And in places like Alabama, they're going to try to make sure they don't exist. They note that Ulster County, New York, is also refusing to produce ballot images. And they finished the editorial saying, cough them up. They're public property. They absolutely are. Keep up the fight down there, Alabama. We'll be watching you. Quick break, and we're back with more broadcast right after this. I'm Brad. Don't go away. Trying to watch that election. That's why I'm saying that the only solution I see to this fine mess is hand-counted paper ballots on election night. But, you know, we'll keep up the fight. We'll take what we can get. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Okay, I want to see if I can get to some listener mail here in the few minutes we have left. But I wanted to note, this is a point I have been arguing that you remember when I said that Republicans in Congress would never allow any gun legislation to go through Congress, no matter how many mass murders we have in this country day after day after day?
Yeah.
Well, looks like I was wrong about that.
Oh.
With lightning speed following mostly party line passage of the measure in the House Judiciary Committee just days earlier, Republicans rammed a bill through the full U.S. House on Wednesday that would make it easier for gun owners to legally carry concealed weapons across state lines. This is the first significant action on guns in Congress since mass shootings in Nevada and Texas killed more than 80 people. The House approved the bill, 231-198, largely along party lines. The measure would allow gun owners with a state-issued concealed carry permit to carry a handgun in any state that allows concealed weapons. That now goes to the Senate. Republicans said this so-called reciprocity measure is a top priority of the National Rifle Association. Of course it is. And that it would allow gun owners to travel freely between states without having to worry about conflicting state laws or civil suits. Opponents, mostly Democrats, say that the bill could endanger public safety by overriding state laws that place strict limits on guns. So once again, so much for those states' rights that Republicans pretend to care about, but only on issues where it's favorable to whatever policy they feel like they should be determined by smaller government at the state level, where states know what is best for their citizens. Nope, not here. Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty of Connecticut called the bill an attempt to undermine states' rights, to hamstring law enforcement and allow dangerous criminals to walk around with hidden guns anywhere at any time. She says it's unspeakable that this is Congress's response to the worst gun tragedies in American history. She represents Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 first graders and 6 educators were fatally shot back in 2012. Numerous police and law enforcement groups oppose this bill, including the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Major Cities Chiefs Association, and the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. So why do Republicans hate law enforcement? I don't know. I guess they're cop haters. Former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who was shot in the head in 2011, she denounced the House action. She says she's angry that when this country is begging for courage from our leaders, they're responding with cowardice. Despite calls by Democrats for tighter gun controls, Congress has taken no steps whatsoever on guns in the following weeks. After the Las Vegas shooting that killed 58 people, the November 5 shooting in Sutherland Springs that killed more than a dozen, or the shooting a week or two ago up in Northern California that killed 5, or the shooting at the high school in New Mexico on Thursday that killed 3, or obviously I could go on and on and on here. The point is, the only action they've taken is the expansion of so-called gun rights. And that's the only action they will take so long as Republicans control Congress and so long as the terrorist-enabling NRA controls that party. As AP reports, the NRA applauded the vote in the U.S. House. The concealed carry bill, they say, is the culmination of a 30-year movement recognizing the right of all law-abiding Americans to defend themselves and their loved ones, including when they cross state lines into states, apparently, that do not want this to happen. So if you, Jesse Larick, communications director for OFA, Organizing for America, said, called this insane, said, for example, that Massachusetts has a rigorous process to obtain a concealed carry permit in Massachusetts, but Vermont has no requirements at all. So under H.R. 38, Jesse Larick argues, a guy from Massachusetts could just buy a gun in Vermont and bring it back in and override Massachusetts state law. And in fact, according to the legislation, if a Massachusetts cop questioned his right to carry, H.R. 3 actually allows him to sue that cop and that police department. All of this, despite, as we recently reported, a new Quinnipiac poll finding that Americans overwhelmingly want more gun safety measures, not less, including over 60% who would support a total ban on the sale of assault weapons and 94% of gun-owning households who would very much like Congress to require universal background checks for all gun sales. I had more on this, and I suspect we'll have more in the days ahead. Ernie Canning, our legal correspondent at the Brad Blog, thinks that this law will be found unconstitutional. Maybe we'll talk about this more in the days ahead. But I wanted to get to some related listener email here. Email from Tom L. to bradcast@bradblog.com, who says the NRA is a terrorist outfit. Dear Brad, the NRA uses the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution to justify or cover their terrorist activities, promoting the sale of dangerous weapons, including gun silencers for private profit. I think you should use the following counterargument that does, that would go well with gun supporters, as well as with the public at large. Tom says the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution does not, and I repeat, does not give anybody the right to purchase and possess weapons for the explicit purpose of killing innocent people. You can argue against the NRA that what happened in Nevada, let's say, was a prime, clear-cut example of how some maniac was using the Second Amendment as cover for purchasing dangerous weapons for the sole or clear-cut purpose of murdering in the first degree innocent people. He says the intent of the shooter was clear, so this argument can be made and counteract the sick and terrorist intentions of the NRA. He says, however, you have to write this concept into the laws of this country. Please read this on air. He says, I enjoy your show, Tom L. Well, thanks, Tom, who apparently really wanted me to read that on air because he sent it like five times today.
Well, thanks, Tom.
Once is fine, Tom. I get them. I get them all. I read them all, even if I can't always reply. I take Tom's point. However, where he argues that the guns in the Nevada case, for instance, were specifically purchased to kill innocent people, I'm not sure how he or we would actually know that.
How would you establish intent?
Yeah, if he bought those guns over a series of years, for example, purportedly for protection or hunting or whatever, how would it be known if he had purchased them to kill innocent people? How would we know that are we supposed to ask the buyer, hey, do you intend to kill innocent people with this gun? So I take the point. I don't know how such a law could actually be enforceable in any way, much less constitutional. That's a separate question. But thank you very much for that, Tom L.
Interesting concept.
More from Jeff K. On a different issue concerning my conversation with Gaius Publius and my contention that Democrats are scared to death of pretty much everything, and therefore they legislate, they react, they legislate out of fear. They turned on Al Franken out of fear of what would be said about them, and so on and so forth. Jeff K. writes, I don't believe it's true. Dear Brad, you are one of the finest people, a half of one of the finest teams broadcasting.
Wow.
Yeah,
I like that.
See,
already.
I thought you'd like it. Finest team broadcasting and publishing on the most urgent issues challenging our democracy. So I don't believe the yarn you were spinning during the Gaius Publius segment. He says one of your go-to rules is facts, just the facts. And yet, your entire characterization of the factors that presage the failure of our Democratic legislators to advance populist safety net measures and quality of life protections, while enthusiastically and without a murmur of dissent voting to outbid Trump and the Republican Party's already shameful, historically immense defense budget proposal by increasing it by $70 billion, your entire characterization of the factors ensuring their continued failure already presupposes that they are, in fact, even committed to advancing such populist egalitarian legislation. You are far too smart, he says, to really believe that hype. Though undoubtedly some Democratic legislators are committed to such goals, Gabby Giffords, Bernie Sanders, et muy poco Al, I think he means Al Franken there. He says, sure, once in a while they might mouth off some of the old Democratic Party boilerplates, but hardly a one displays even a minute sign of real commitment to those beliefs when it comes to job performance and when, in a supposed democracy, we are appraising our representatives in government. It is job performance that is the facts, just the facts. So essentially, he's taking Gaius's point here in saying that, no, it's not because they're afraid. It's because
they really like it this way.
They like it this way. They are bought off by the corporations, just like the Republicans. Jeff K. adds, I thank the skies every day for you both and all you do. Much love, Jeff. And he adds, I pledge to pledge a show of financial support before the end of the year. Broadcast is a treasure.
Well,
thank you so much, Jeff K., whether you agree with me or not. I appreciate that pledge of support at bradblog.com/donate. If you share Jeff's ideas or mine,
share your
or
thoughts.
Disagree with them in any way. I had one more here that I wanted to get to because the subject line was Mr. Obtuse, and it starts, Brad, you obtuse goofball, talking about our conversation on Russia and the investigation there. We will have to hold that for another time from Randall H. Sorry about that. But thank you all for your input anytime. For or again me, anyway. All right. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us and for sending in your emails to bradcast@bradblog.com. You can also find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters while we're still here at the Brad Blog. And again, bradblog.com/donate. If you would like to help keep us on the air before or after the end of this year. I think that's it. Is that all?
That's all.
All right, good. All right, until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.